Test, test. This is David Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center. And this is May 20th, 1986. And we are in sunny California in the lovely little town of Hemet, H-E-M-E-T, which is... And we are talking today with Franklin Crick Hershey, H-E-R-S-H-E-Y. Mr. Hershey is a venerable but still very active pioneer automotive designer. Worked for several companies and has had a marvelous career, long career. And we were fortunate. And Mr. Hershey has been gracious enough to present us today with his career narrative, and we'll ask him to give this narrative in his own words and in his own way.
My mother and father lived in Detroit. I was born in Detroit in 1907. My father had a store down on what's that big square downtown?
Alex Square?
No. Another one, just before you come down Woodward and you hit the town park, there's a park right there. Big park. It's on both sides of Woodward.
We'll put it in later. Yeah.
He had a store.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And he knew all the automotive people, Henry Ford. He knew Brush. He knew Henry Leland was a good friend of my mother's and father's. Mm-hmm. Of course, my father and mother were young, a couple. Mm-hmm. And he knew the Dodge brothers and a lot of other people, which I just can't remember right now. But at any rate...
What kind of store did he have?
Huh?
What kind of a store did he have?
This would be funny. He had a children's clothing store.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he and my uncle owned the building there, one of the buildings.
What was the name?
I don't remember what it was.
Was it Hershey and...
Hershey and Quick, I think.
Fine.
My mother's maiden name was Quick, and my uncle's name was Franklin P. Quick.
Uh-huh.
For Franklin Pierce, the stupid president he was named for. At any rate, of course, my mother was the first woman, as far as I can remember, and I've heard as the first woman in Detroit to own a car. It was a 1903 Cadillac.
Really?
And she was taught by Leland Chauffeur. And we had a Cadillac almost every year up to about 1922.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we bought a new Cadillac. And so naturally I've been a Cadillac fan all my life,
mm-hmm.
but I've fallen in love with other ones in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, my mother decided she was going to move to California. Well, she made a trip with me before my sister was born to California. I think I was a year old.
Mm-hmm.
And by reason of that trip and following one, I became absolutely fascinated with trains also, because I remember one of the things I can remember when I was 3 years old was getting on the train for the final trip out here, and a lot of things that impressed me, and I still remember that. I can smell the smoke in the station. I can see the vestibule and the bellows between the two cars really fascinated me, and the little pressed glass window in the toilet there. I remember that all these years, and I remember the station was sort of smoky and it was sort of dark but real mysterious. And we went up the steps and got on the platform and finally into the compartment. Anyhow, we moved to California in 1909, and in the meantime, my father, I didn't know this till some years later. My father and my uncle owned an automobile agency on Main Street. They sold, of all things, Franklin's and American. But my father was a financial interest with him rather than a participation until we moved out here.
Mm-hmm.
And
where was Main Street again?
Main Street, Los Angeles.
Fine.
Main Street.
Yeah.
I have a picture of it.
You moved directly to Los Angeles.
Yeah, and then my mother bought a lot in Beverly Hills. And we built a house there in 1909, finished in 1910, and I think we were about the eighth house in Beverly Hills at that time. And my father was in business with Harry Culver, and they founded Culver City. And Harry Culver and Eunice Culver was a very good friend of ours, and I remember they had a big coal town car, and she was a sort of a Annie Mame type of person, very flamboyant and full of fun and feathers and furs and just a great person. And Harry was sort of, you know, just a good old businessman.
Is that C-O-L-E, coal town car?
Culver, C-U-L-V-E-R.
No, the town car that they had.
Coal, C-O-L-E, yeah, coal town. It was an 8-cylinder coal. Well, I don't know at that time. It was later on. It was an 8-cylinder coal. They came out about 1916 after Cadillac. At any rate, we moved to Beverly Hills, and my father had a Lozier. We had a Cadillac. The Cadillac I remember more than anything was first the 1912, and then got the 13, and then we got a 14. But my father had a Lozier race about, and there was nothing in Beverly Hills then. Of course, Beverly Hills now is the crown jewel of the world, I guess.
Excuse me, for the typist, Lozier is spelled
L-O-Z-I-E-R, I think,
right.
Lozier.
Thank you.
Well, I look it up, but
that's right, yeah.
The Lozier was the Rolls Royce of this country.
It was it?
Oh, Lozier was a fantastic automobile, beautifully built. Mm-hmm. And so he used to fire that thing up. I have a picture of 180 degrees facing north from Santa Monica to Los Angeles, and there's the old Beverly Hotel, which is brand new then, just finished it. Matter of fact, they were finishing it when we moved there.
Mm.
And he used to take an old gunny sack and drive up the hill Sunday morning, and he had to put a great big brass exhaust pipe on there, and no muffler. And oh God, that big 6-cylinder car, you know, great big fantastic car.
Mm-hmm.
He'd head up for the hills, and he'd come back with a gunny sack full of quail, sometimes grouse. From the hills, it was wild. Now the hills are all houses.
Mm-hmm.
And every Sunday. And we had, at any rate, another story that happened. He was, I think it was 1913. He was driving, he had an office in Los Angeles, and he was driving home one night, and Wilshire was just a little on narrow McAdam Road. And it passed the pits there,
the
La Brea Tar pits. Well, it made a curve. But my father fell asleep, and he went straight and right into the tar pit.
Oh.
And the front end started to sink,
right.
But slowly,
because
he was going to end up with the saber-toothed tigers.
Yes.
But fortunately, a man with a truck behind him, I think it was an old Mack truck or something, pulled up and pulled him out. Oh, that car was a god-awful mess. My father saved the car, but
yeah.
My father could have gotten out. And so that's just a side story. There was
no railing of any kind.
Huh?
No railing, no.
Oh no, they had a little rail fence, just a old wooden fence. You know, it was half
that.
Down and half up. It was, they didn't take it too seriously at that time. The tar pits. Remember another time, my father was selling a piece of real estate. He Harry Culver in the real estate business. And remember, they were selling out near Pasadena. There was a olive grove, and I was sat in the back seat. There was a 1914 Cadillac then, great big devil, and. I was sitting in a tonneau, and I think Harry and the customer and my father were sitting in the front seat. And went out to show him this olive grove. And we're driving through the grove, and suddenly, whamble, the wheel caught and threw a rattlesnake right up the back seat with me.
Oh, no! Still alive.
Well, it scared the daylights out of me, but of course, a rattlesnake can't strike unless it's caught. See, he was sort of stunned anyhow, so my father went around and picked it up and threw it out. But, oh, my God. That doesn't happen in these days unless you have a convertible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, to make a long story short, my father and mother. Well, I'll tell you another story, anecdote. I went to military school, and my mother, after my father and mother were divorced, and we sold the house in Beverly Hills. My mother put me in Urban Military Academy on 8th and Alvarado.
What was the name?
Urban.
Urban?
Yeah, it was the, it's still there. I mean, it's not there, but it's still out by Will Rogers Park.
But in what municipality?
Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, sir.
There were three or four others. There was Harvard and Oneonta and Harvard School and another one. I can't remember the name of it right now. But at any rate,
Oneonta?
Oneonta, I don't know how it's spelled.
Right.
Well, it's a suburb of Pasadena.
Okay.
And my father, while my mother was on a European trip, my father would come and see me on almost every weekend, and he had a Studebaker. And across, this was during the war, and across from the house, there was a huge big wooden house. These were all big wooden houses on,
right.
on 8th Street then, right near Westlake Park, which is now McCarthy's Park.
What street would you say?
Harvard. I mean, 8th and Alvarado. Alvarado ran north and south, ran east and west, and Alvarado ran north and south, and Wilshire ran east and west. Well, Wilshire now runs they put a bridge through the lake,
mm-hmm.
and there's two lakes now or something. And in those days, it was just one Westlake Park.
And the park was
Westlake.
And later called what?
MacArthur.
MacArthur Park. Right.
Anyhow, my father had taken me for a ride, Studebaker, and he brought me back to school room, and we had a front lawn that sort of sloped down toward the sidewalk and then the street, and there were three of us sitting out there on the lawn, and my father said goodbye, and he drove over to the to this great huge house, which was it's where the nurses and all wrapped bandages and all kinds of things for the war, see.
Mm-hmm.
But on the corner was a gas station. They had taken corner part of the property and made a gas station. Well, in those days, you pump the gasoline with your hand, you put the hose in, and then when you were done, you lifted the hose up to get all the gas out of the hose into your tank. Well, my father smoked, he was a chain cigar smoker,
mm.
and he had this great big stogie in his hand. He was sitting in the front seat, and he asked the attendant something, and so the attendant came around with a hose in his hand, and my father, you know, turned and stuck the cigar right in the end of the hose.
Oh, no.
And it started a fire.
Congrats.
Well, the hose still had full gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So the attendant jumped and dropped the hose and it spilled gasoline. Mm-hmm. My father had enough sense to start the car and get out, see,
yeah.
before it burned up.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it burned the whole damn house down.
Oh, no.
And we were all clapping. My father burned the house down. All the kids were having so much fun. Nobody was hurt, but
the house that
with all this wood
was behind the gas station.
Behind the gas station.
Oh,
well, very close to it, as a matter
yeah.
of fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have very big front lawns on those days, but big houses. Well, most of these houses had horse barns in behind. We had big horse, big stables in behind us. And I said, this was, hell, this was 1916.
Mm-hmm. Still riding country.
No, no, no. Well, in those days, I mean, there was horses. Automobiles weren't, they were getting plentiful. Sure they were, but they still had horses.
Yeah.
The milkmen had horses. And
right.
And they still had hauled horses hauling dirt and stuff like that. But anyhow, that's, so then, make a long story short.
How did you like military school?
I hated it.
Okay.
Well, I ran away.
Did
I kept
you?
Running away all the time. And my aunt had this house still in Beverly Hills. I'd run to her and they'd come and get me. And there's a lot of stories connected to that school, but it takes too long to tell them now, and it has nothing to do with
right.
this story particularly. At any rate, we moved to Sierra Vista for a while. Oh, my mother bought a walnut ranch out of Peonti.
Where?
In Peonti.
How do you spell that?
P-U-E-N-T-E, La Puente. It's the bridge in Spanish. There's a bridge within miles of the place.
Where's
Well, it's south of Covina and east of El Monte and west of Pomona, if that tells you anything.
That's perfect.
it's on the what they call the Valley Boulevard, just to be the main boulevard
mm-hmm.
run east and west.
Was that an income property for
you? Yeah, it was walnuts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And my mother and sister and I ran it, and we didn't have any business buying the damn thing because we lost our shirt on it.
Mm.
We made some money 1 or 2 years, but anyhow, we still had this big 18 Cadillac 57, model 57, which I loved. I loved that car. So I'm glad we took it up to Tahoe, and my mother drove it up on these god-awful mountain roads
oh,
and
yes.
everything, you know.
Those
Jesus.
Days it must have been scary.
Oh, there was, see, I mean, Tahoe wasn't the resort that it is now,
right.
but I was people where people went on vacation with tents and all of the tents, and you fished, and you had fun, swam,
mm-hmm.
and there was nothing much there. There's a little south of the lake called Tulac. There was a place called Tulac where we camped. We used to camp for 2 months. T-L-A-C-A. No. TLLAC, Tlac. And another little store, which I can't remember.
Yeah.
Anyhow, my mother finally decided we didn't need the Cadillac there on the ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And so she bought a 1921 Model A, Model T sedan. One with a Volvo window in the back and one door on the sides.
Oh, yes.
And we used that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, in the rainy season, it was muddy there and so we used that. My uncle, I call him uncle, he was one of my mother's suitors, had two cars and left one there for her, off and on, a Buick Roadster. I first drove the Cadillac before she sold it. We went downtown in Peabody, which is 2 miles south of our ranch. The town is still there. It hasn't changed a bit, but it's all these marvelous houses and condominiums have grown up all around, but the town is the same.
Mm-hmm.
Same old building, same everything.
La Puente.
And so she decided she's going to leave the car there, parked by the bank, and she walked 2 blocks up to get some bread or something. Well, either to hell with that. So I got in and I drove up there.
How old were you?
I think I was 12 or 13, I guess. And I guess I was 13. And I drove the car and parked in front of where she was. She came out and started down there. She took a double take and saw me. And oh boy, I nearly got it. But that gave me such a thrill, I'd never forgotten it. Well, when we sold it, I was so lonesome for that car, that particular Cadillac, because I loved, the radiator, just the huskiness of the car, it always made an impression on me. We had this Roadster before that I showed you here.
Yes.
And we used to drive all around. My sister rode in that rumble seat because while we still lived in Beverly Hills, they had started to build a swimming club down on the ocean I can't remember the name. Anyhow, it was a great big huge building, about 7 or 8 stories, and we had two swimming pools and three ballrooms and all kinds of stuff. It was a private club. It cost $3,000 in those days to join it. And then you had so much dues. But at any rate, I remember riding in the back in the tonneau of that Cadillac all the time. I mean, in the rumble seat. I loved that Cadillac. Well, there was just something about Cadillac that I loved. And I used to draw them. I'd sit in school when I was in high school and draw all the time. The teachers would get beside themselves, you know, you're wasting your time. Well, and then I inherited the sedan.
The Buick sedan?
Yeah, no, I inherited the Ford.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
I drove that Ford all over. I drove it, I put 110,000 miles on that sedan.
Wow.
But I could overhaul that engine. You know, you could buy a whole new engine for $10 in those days. Your carburetor, I think, was $1.75, something like that.
Uh-huh.
And the cylinder head, I think, was $1.25. And I know the timer on there was 35 cents for the timer. Oh, it was so simple.
Mm-hmm.
But it was made out of fantastic material, so they run and run and run. Well, then I don't remember. No, we still had the sedan. In the meantime, I bought a Ford, just a chassis and a hood and a seat and a windshield. And put a big box on the back there, and I used to drive that all over. Down the Salton Sea, that's 250 miles away in the hot sun with no top on it, no nothing. And drive it all over the desert. I used to drive it out of Randsburg and Johannesburg, out of these old mining towns.
Mm-hmm.
And into Arizona, just a friend and I, we drove, spent all summer doing that.
Wow.
And I remember Palm Springs. I have a picture of it. Well, I used to go to Palm Springs, had nothing there but a beautiful canyon with the water and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this one particular time, I had this car, this Ford, and we burned a rod. Now here we were 60 miles from anywhere, 60 miles from Indio, well, maybe 40 miles from Indio, but and it was hotter than hell.
Mm-hmm.
And we bursted a tire at the same time. And it was hotter than hell. So I said, what are you going to do? 60 miles away, how are we got to go? You know, can't die out here.
Not in Palm Springs.
No, it was just a little old house that the lady owned. Mm-hmm. He lived there. Mm-hmm. Oh, at that time, it wasn't Palm Springs, wasn't anything.
Yeah.
That was very early 20s. Well, I had a big leather belt on me, and I remember across the street from our ranch was a very good friend of ours, and I used to help him. He had a great big pump. He pumped water with, and it was a great big one-cylinder cylinder laid on its side in this great big thing, and he burnt a bearing. You know, he used the leather bearings in those things with oil, leather bearings for some reason. It was very slow, you know.
Right.
And so I thought, geez, let's see if this will work. So we cut a piece and put it in there on the conrod. And we took the babbitt out. See, that was poured. Those were poured in those days, and you had to scrape those in with bluing. Mm. Oh, it took ages to scrape that thing in. You had to get it so where the blue was all even around, and then bring it on. So we put this piece of leather in there, and we fixed the tire, got a spare tire. And we came back. I drove that thing for, I drove it for a couple of months until I forgot all about that damn bearing in there. And the car ran great. Of course, I was going to college then too at the same time, right? But I drove it. I finally, oh my God, that bearing! I took it out, and the leather was still good.
Isn't that incredible?
So anyhow,
where were you going to college?
Occidental, which Occidental? Was just, see, we lived in Eagle Rock then, because my mother sold the ranch and she moved to Eagle Rock.
Okay.
But I was still my last year in high school, and still had about 6 or 7 months to go. So I lived all this stuff going to be interesting to these people?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, I lived in a little, what they call a Sunnyside hotel.
Yeah.
And they had a son. Their son was about a year and a half, 2 years younger than I. And I remember the father, they owned a dairy too, mm-hmm. a nice dairy. Mm-hmm. And I used to go out and work in the dairy. And then we used to, Albert and I delivered the milk, and they had a Dodge truck,
mm-hmm.
and I used to drive that Dodge all over, you know, the crazy gear shift on the thing, and boy, it was a good old car, just lug along all the time, never had any trouble. So then, when my mother moved, she bought a Huttmobile. The new Huttmobile, it was a really good looking car. See, after the, about 1928, LaSalle had a, when the LaSalle came out, I thought that was the most beautiful car in the world. And then Huttmobile brought out a new series, which was a hell of a good looking car. And it was patterned, sort of, all the cars then, most of them had a LaSalle type of radiator, which hardly ever took from Hispano Suiza. Everybody knew that. And she bought this Huttmobile. In the meantime, my sister had taken up flying.
Really?
And, well, she was bored with life.
Ah, okay.
It's terribly bored with life.
That was the new frontier in those days.
Yeah,
flying.
And this was 1927 around there. And Walter M. Oh, no, she took it up after I went to Murphy's. All right, that was 1928. Because Murphy owned a flying field down here near Santa Ana somewhere.
China.
Or La Harbor or somewhere, I don't remember where it was, but they had a flying field, and they had a great big handsome, half Jewish and half Irish, great handsome, wonderful guy, just a wonderful flyer, and he taught my sister to fly, and she knew Bobby Trout, who was a very famous girl flyer, and she also knew Amelia Earhart, my sister, and at that time, I was. Well, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, because Wellwood Beals, who became the managing director of Boeing, he was the head of Boeing for years.
Can I spell his last name?
What did I say his name was?
Beals.
Beals, B-E-A-L-S, Beals. Okay. Wellwood Beals.
Wellwood
Beals.
Wellwood.
Oh, yes, he was head of all Boeing.
Was he?
Years. Oh, yeah, sure. But he and I he became friends. Let's go back. Anyhow, while we were living in Eagle Rock, and I was going to Occidental,
mm-hmm.
I still was nuts about cars.
Where is Occidental, by the way?
Occidental is in Eagle Rock.
It's right in Eagle Rock?
Yeah, just about 2 miles from my house, mile and a half from my house.
Mm-hmm.
for our house then.
Yeah.
And
Occidental College.
And so I was drawing some automobiles at home, and this is one of them I drew. I drew three. Mac says he doesn't have it, but I gave. It had a V-shaped radiator.
What was it again?
It's the car.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you mean it was a big Fiat, Cadillac size.
Which was in those days a four-door touring car, roughly.
Well, a short couple touring car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
It wasn't seven passenger.
Ah.
Because he didn't have the jump seats.
Mm-hmm.
So it was close. Fiat, my favorite body model anyhow, always has been.
Yeah.
And most of the car collectors, they rather prefer Fiat's than anything else.
What characterized it?
That's why I wanted to find it short to you, because it's hard to describe it. I don't even remember too much about it myself. I had long fenders and side tire mounts and disc wheels and a V-shaped radiator.
Advanced for its day.
Well, yes, it was. It was advanced over the LaSalle
mm-hmm.
in its day. Anyhow,
which had come out.
Came out in 1928. The LaSalle. I remember going to Los Angeles and seeing it. I tried to get my mother to buy one, but she bought a new Huntmobile instead, a big 100 horsepower automobile, which was a bomb. And I remember going down there, and we went down and looked at the L car, and I sort of liked the L car. But then I saw the wooden dash on the L car. You know not the instrument board, but the dash between the body and the hood, and they still were using oak.
Really?
And I'm like, yeah, here's a modern car with oak.
Elcar spelled?
E-L-C-A-R. It was a, come from Elkhart, Indiana.
Oh, Elkhart.
Yeah, Elkhart.
Uh-huh. From Elkhart, Indiana.
Yeah, but they didn't call it Elkhart, they just called it Elkar.
Right.
And it had a Lycoming engine in it. I think they first started out with Continentals, and they put Lycoming in it. Anyhow, I sort of liked the L car, but it had a Rolls Royce type radiator.
Oh, yes.
And it was sort of a nice looking car. But, and it smelled so good. Cars in those days smell.
Didn't they?
They don't, the new ones don't smell like, but the cars in those days smelled. They had a lovely smell to them.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, somebody told me that there was a custom body place in Pasadena. I should take the cars over. I mean, the pictures over. So I took them over and showed them to Frank Spring.
These are your drawings.
Yeah, and he sort of liked that, and he says, well...
Spring was
well, he was managing director of Murphy's.
Murphy Body Company.
Yeah. And he looked at him, and, you might make it someday. Come back and see me 10 years from now.
What kind of guy was Frank Spring?
Well, we became very later on.
Yeah, we'll get to him.
When I wasn't working for him, we became very good friends.
Good.
No, Frank Spring was a gadgeteer. He loved gadgets, all kinds of gadgets. But he was a very good salesman, very British in his action. He wasn't British, but he was very British. In his clothes, his demeanor, and his speech and everything else. Well, he came from some college in the East, you know. They had a very, very highfalutin English or Eastern accent,
mm-hmm.
And he was a lot of fun to be around. But he and Brazier Breeze. Brazier. The hell was his name? What was his first name? His name was Breeze. Breeze.
I suppose his last name.
B-R-E-E-Z-E, I think. Or
okay.
B-R-E-E-S-E. Breeze. Drank mate all the time out of gourds with silver sippers. It's a mate was a kind of a of a southern tea that gave you a little bit of a lift, you know.
M-A-T-T-E,
I think, mate. And I remember them bringing, they had these very, very elegant, ornate silver straws made out of silver. But they always had the mate there all the time. So my mother's financial advisor, who was a very wonderful man, and who was a very fine man and a very wealthy man, and whom my mother never paid attention to. If she had, she'd been worth millions now.
Oh,
and I might have drunk myself to death, who knows. But at any rate, he was a very good friend of Walter M. Murphy. See, Walter M. Murphy owned the Murphy body, but he never was there.
Oh,
see, he owned the Hudson Essex dealership.
Uh-huh, in Pasadena?
And not the dealership, he owned, in those days, they had what they called the...
Regional
thing, he owned the whole thing. Right. There's a name for it, I can't remember.
Franchise?
Well, more than that.
Distributorship.
Well, for all Southern California.
Right.
Hudson Essex. Mm. And, of course, we made a lot of custom Hudson cars
right.
for his wife. Hudson, I designed a Hudson Town car for him, and a Hudson convertible for a passenger, Phaeton. And my mother was telling him about this deal, and he said, oh, that son of a gun. He said, yes, let me see what I can do. So this is about 2 months, just before Christmas, he called up one day and said, I got a Christmas present for you. And he said, well, I'm going to come out and tell you. So he came out the house. He said, Frank, you go over and see Frank Spring. He's going to give you a job. So I went over and I walked into Frank Spring. He said, oh. And Frank Spring looked up at me. He said, what, you again? He says, yeah, how long do you think you'll last? Well, George McCrary was doing the drawing upstairs.
M.C.
McCrary, oh, God.
For the
M.C., I can find out the spelling later on. I've got it somewhere.
I think it's M.C.C.R.A.R.
No.
No?
Maybe. I thought it was E.E., but maybe it's E.R. I'm no good speller anyhow.
McCrary.
Okay. His father was he was the accountant for the firm.
Okay.
And George was drawing line drawings. He never made any color drawings. He made line drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good. George... was a he was good at what he was doing. He wasn't he didn't have any great imagination, but he was a good draftsman.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, after about 4 or 5 months, they put him on doing other things, and then I was up there more or less alone. But he did show me how to make the kind of drawings that we had to make.
Mm-hmm.
Line drawing.
Mm-hmm.
He showed me that. Well, then I was doing a lot of drawing in there, and suddenly Phil Wright shows up.
Uh-huh.
And Phil Wright was a fantastic watercolor artist, and he could take and Mac could have showed you some of his work.
Mm-hmm.
He could that I gave Mac. Mm-hmm. He used to make these little sketches. That he brought some of these that he had at General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
He would take and draw a whole car without a line or anything, just with watercolors, and it was crude but beautifully crude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. You could get the whole feeling of the car. He was really good.
Phil Wright had been with General Motors.
Phil Wright had been with General Motors, and he started telling me how wonderful it was, and so on and so forth.
Excuse me, what year did you start with Murphy?
1928. And I think it was just before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
In 1928. And so I don't know, it was the end of 28 or the, I think it was the beginning of 28. Yeah, it was. And so he kept telling me how they needed people in General Motors and so on and so forth. I didn't realize at the time, he wanted to get me out of there. Phil Wright did.
Oh, really?
Well, Phil Wright came, but Phil Wright was a weirdo in many respects. He was a good kid, but a great artist. And he probably had TB. Somebody told him he had TB.
Mm-hmm.
And he went with Frank Spring. Now look, he said, let me live on the desert. I'll live on the desert. I'll bring my drawings in every weekend because I'd have to live out in the dry desert and so on. So Phil bought a brand new Model A, the first Model A, the low hood Model A, Roadster, to live out in the desert. So Frank Spring said, now you go with George out every weekend till he finds an old shack out there to live on. Well, that's the most stupid thing ever. What? No, there's no, if there was a shack on the desert, it'd be long gone by now, and if there wouldn't be any water there, you know. But Phil didn't know that. And I thought, well, let's do it. I get a free trip every weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent two or three weekends, and we couldn't find any place, you know.
Where'd you go?
I don't remember. I know we went all over out. We went to out to Barstow and then out to around in there, Indio. And, no, it didn't go down to Indio. We went out to Palm Springs and all over. I don't remember now. Mm-hmm. We'd camp at night and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, Frank Spinney had enough of that. And he said, he said, you know, you'll never find a place. In the first place, you could find a place on the desert, but you couldn't afford to live there. And, and so he said, you stay in here. And so...
Speaking to you, or...?
Speaking to Frank Spring.
Or to?
Frank Spring. He was telling us to Frank Spring that Frank Spring said, you stay here now and work. No more desert business.
You are...
To George.
George McCrary.
Phil Wright. Phil Wright. I got the names mixed up. Phil Wright.
Yeah.
Said, you stay in here now and forget the desert.
Okay, yeah.
So Phil showed me how to do some watercolors.
Mm-hmm.
I had done things in watercolor before. In art school, this is one of the things I won a prize in when I was in high school, 1922, I think it was, 23.
Really?
Yeah. It was a wild thing. Nobody understood why I made it, and I didn't either.
Uh-huh.
But I thought it was sort of fun, so I had it framed by a friend of mine.
When did you do that?
1922, I think.
In high school?
In high school.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of the kind of stuff that they do now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very.
Anyhow, it was crazy. So I started to, but then I got a hold of a LeBaron catalog. And the drawings were, the color renderings were there by Stickney. And by God, I'm going to learn to do this. I'm going to learn to do drawings like that.
What was his first name?
Stickney. He was a grand old man of the water.
Stickney.
I guess so. Mac would know for sure. I thought I was going to do that. I was going to learn to do it just like, and I did. I worked till I had. Let me put it this way. In the meantime, Wellwood Beals, we were building an airplane, and George B. Fuller was the airplane engineer, and he was a good one of the top ones in the country. And
you and Beals were building.
No, George Fuller was there, working on a wing design for a plane.
Okay.
Of a stretched metal, which hadn't been done before.
This is at Merkin.
Yeah,
right.
And so then they hired Wellwood Beals just out of Guggenheim Foundation in Denver,
mm-hmm.
young design engineer, and they hired him. It was his first job.
Mm-hmm.
And if they'd had a computer in those days, but they were reams and reams of papers with figures that, oh my God, he couldn't believe it. Calculation, the computation, I couldn't believe it. I go nuts with that kind of stuff. So in the meantime.
You're talking about airplane design.
Yeah, in the meantime, Phil Wright had gotten to me. And he said, you ought to go back and get a job with General Motors. See, I was making $90 a month there. Of course, it was good. I bought a new car, bought a new Ford with a big radiator on it, the second series Ford.
On time?
Ace. No, it only cost $325.
Oh, marvelous, yeah.
Well, you could buy a Pontiac convertible in 1935 for $400. So what the hell? Yeah, it was a Roadster.
Mm-hmm.
So that was no great chase. But I finally decided I was going to go to Detroit.
What year was it?
But in the meantime, this was still 1928.
Mm-hmm.
It was the summer before the crash. I think I went in. It was spring when I went back.
Uh-huh.
And Phil Wright was ecstatic, getting rid of this guy. So
you two didn't get along.
We got along fine. But no, this was just something I sort of sensed that he wanted.
He thought
if he get rid of me, he'd have the whole pie by himself.
You were in his way, in fact.
Well, yeah, I don't think it was malicious. I think he just thought, in the meantime. Wellwood Beals had gone to Detroit before he came out here, and he still had a return ticket. So he said, look, I'll give you the ticket. But he said you have to go to San Francisco and take the train from San Francisco. So I went to San Francisco, and I was dressed like Los Angeles. I had two-toned shoes and sort of the sport pants, and I got up to San Francisco walking around. Everybody's looking at me like I was some freak, you know, with these brown and white shoes and so on. They could believe that. So I finally got tired of walking around San Francisco and looked at it. So they had parked the train over in the yard. See, they didn't have trains right in town. They parked them in Oakland side.
Oh my gosh.
So I went back, and I went about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the train wasn't supposed to leave till about 7 or 8 o'clock that night, see. And I found my Pullman all by itself out in the yard. So I went in and woke up the porter. He said, "Oh my God, are you back?" He said, "You're early." And I said, "Well, look, I can't take San Francisco." And he said, "Well, come on in." So I stayed there until the train left. So I got back to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, because I was using his ticket, that I should assume his name. So, you know, I was going back as well with beers, had a few complications. You know, had a few complications. So I met a little old lady, a really sweet little old lady, and we sat and talked and talked. And finally, at the end of the trip, I said, "Well, it was very tough for me to make it, because I was a very, sort of a, in a way, very shy, you know." And I said, "I've got the confession. That is my real name. My real name is so-and-so." She said, "Well, I figured that something was wrong." I said, "Well, it's because," she said, "it didn't make any difference whose name was on the ticket. It's a..." "Well, now you tell me." So anyhow, I was out of money. So I stayed in a flop house. I had $3 left in Detroit. Down around the ginger ale. Burner's ginger ale building.
Plant, yeah.
It was a nice clean bed and all for a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day I went over to, and they hired me immediately at General Motors.
Wait a minute, don't go so fast. Who'd you go see?
I didn't see Harley. I saw, I went in and sat down, because the design department was in the building just attached to the General Motors building. In the back was a lower building, and that was the engineering building.
Okay.
And they had a few rooms there.
Mm-hmm.
Not very big. They had a modeling room outside, and then they had a room about maybe twice as, about the size of this whole area in here, where they had the artists.
Is it mid-28? Or mid?
Yeah, it was the early 28. And
how was the weather?
Oh, the spring weather. It was nice,
okay.
Nice weather. And my mother's and father's best friend still lived there, and he was the chief artist on the American Boy.
What was
he? William Clark. And
American Boy was a popular magazine.
Was a very popular magazine, and he'd studied in Paris with all the famous old guys. He knew all these great artists that, you know, very famous.
Yeah.
And they had a house on LaSalle Gardens.
Where was that?
Well, you go out Grand to the west for a little ways, and then you turn north, and it's just a,
mm-hmm.
It was a nice area, but typical old two-story, you know,
mm-hmm. Right.
Detroit houses.
Right.
So I went out to see them the next day. They said, "Oh, you got to come and live with us." So they had Bill Clark, young Bill at that time, I think it was about 15 or so, and then they had the older Clark boy, and I think he was going off to school. Anyhow, I lived there with him.
Your mother told you to look them up.
Oh yeah, sure to look them up.
Yeah.
And they're happy to have me, so I didn't have to live in the flop house anymore.
No.
But then I started working at GM, and there was a fellow by there. There was, I'll tell you who was there. Jack Morgan was there. A fellow by the name of, now I can't remember his name, he came from a very wealthy family in Boston. Typical Boston fellow. Fellow built about a little bit taller than you, but very nicely built, and a fantastic artist, but he was a jewelry artist.
Oh.
He used to do all the little hubcaps, about miniature size, about the size of a pea, and but absolutely perfect. Oh God, they were just gems. I wish I'd kept some of them. Yeah, I'll think of his name pretty soon. I just thought of it the other day. And little old Jackie Aldrich was there.
Oh, yes.
You heard of him.
Heard of him, yeah.
Jackie Aldrich was there. Morgan, And of course, oh dear, I just had his name. He was a draftsman, sort of. Well, he was doing drawings too, but he wasn't that good. But he later on became head of the draftsman in a way, to some degree. And that was, I think it was his name. Yeah, he was there, and a couple others, which I don't remember right now. And
had the department been established?
Sure. It was. And I remember walking out in the back where I just walked out. I didn't know where I was going, and suddenly here was this beautiful Cadillac Phaeton, all in clay, all finished in clay. I couldn't believe it. I have a picture of it somewhere. Yeah. Beautiful Phaeton. Mm-hmm. And God, it had the swooping back fenders, and it was more or less the prototype, I think, of my favorite Cadillac, which is a 31 or 32. Mm-hmm. At any rate, I remember I was making hubcaps for Pontiac.
That was your first assignment?
My first assignment. I was drawing hubcaps, and I was doing pretty good. I was getting good training in it. And so then I went to Chicago to the salon in the Great Hotel. I think it was great.
Automobile,
you know, they had an automobile salon every year. All the great car builders like Murphy and Dietrich and Willoughby and all those were there. And I remember seeing Frank, met Frank Spring, and he said, "Oh boy," he said, "we want you back." I said, "Well, God, I was making $90 out there. I'm not coming back for any $90.
What were you making General Motors to start?
$300.
Oh my God.
Okay. Making $300. Yeah. And so I said, "Well, look, I'll come back for $300. And he nearly fainted, see. And he said, "Well, I got to go back and talk to Frank Spring." He said, we've got seven new town cars.
Wait, this is Frank you ran into?
No, I ran into Brzee.
Brzee, okay.
Brzee.
You said it was Frank.
No, Lamar Brzee was his name.
Lamar Brzee.
Brzee. Okay. This other name is... I've been thinking, and who was there too, I'll think in a minute. And Lamar Brzee, he said, "I got to go back and talk to Frank Spring." But he said, I'll send you a telegram. So, but he said, "We really need you." Well,
what was the reason? You said they had seven new
Seven new town cars to do. Of a design that I had made, but they had each interior had to be different.
Mm.
And this was her nouveau... it's the kind of art that's sort of coming back right now.
Art Nouveau or Art Deco?
Well, Art Deco, more of it.
Okay.
And that's what the kind of, I mean, with the different kinds of ice hanging down and things like that. So, but that's beside the point. It was getting fall. Fall was coming along. And we hadn't had a snow yet. And then suddenly the crash came, the market crash came. And I saved a little money. And General Motors went down to seven. And I'm not very astute at this kind of thing. I've never been money. My head never worked with money. So I had a couple hundred dollars. I think I'll go buy some General Motors stock. So I go down there in the bank, and there is Al Fisher there.
One of the Fisher brothers.
Yeah, I had met them because they were hanging around all the time.
Was that Alfred Fisher?
Alfred Fisher. And... or AJ, I forgot it was AJ or Alfred. Anyhow, I reneged. I decided not to buy it. I saved my money. And I get out in the hall, Mr. Fisher said, "What are you so worried about?" I said, "Well," I said, "the GM went down to seven. I was scared to buy him stock." See, he said, "Well, that's nothing. I was going to put $15,000 on stock, and I didn't buy it either." Well, that didn't make me feel any better. At any rate, then after the crash, we all got a letter, the ones that were there, Aldrich and Morgan and myself, that saying that, "Don't worry, as long as General Motors existed, we'd have a job." But in the meantime, I got a letter from Brzee. And he said, "Come back. We'll pay you the $300. Well, I was homesick. California. Because I'm in California. Yeah, I was homesick. So I decided to leave. And they said, well, anytime you want to come back, you can come back. So...
Now, had you met Harley Earl by this time?
Yeah, I had met Harley Earl, but I hadn't seen very much of him. I was not impressed. I didn't really know what kind of a person he was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know the kind of the son of a bitch he was. But I, long, long story. Now, in retrospect, I look back, and he was one hell of a guy, with all of his faults and so on. I could see now what made him tick. I couldn't then. I, you know, we were young, and he started... It was a love-hate relationship, especially with me, because I realized, I've learned after the fact that I was his pet. I didn't know that. Anyhow, Captur, Vince Captur is the guy that was there.
K-A-P-T-U-R.
Vince Captur, he's in, see the picnic there, 1935 picnic there.
Oh, there's
100 of them there. Not many of them left. Only 4 or 5 of this whole gang left.
Incredible.
And I was sitting right next to, I'm standing right next to Harley. Anyhow,
I got homesick,
and so I decided to come home. Mm-hmm. Well, now, in those days, there weren't any through buses. The buses were all just the makeshift buses. They had old Fagels, these great big Fagel buses, which were nice buses. They were sort of parlor buses.
How do you spell Fagel?
Huh?
How do you spell it? Remember?
F-A-G-O-E-L, or so well, I some Fagel.
O-E-L, yeah. Yeah. Fagel. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You have to look it up. And you say you went from Detroit to Chicago, then you got another bus to St. Louis, then you got another bus to Denver, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And any kind of bus as well. Mrs. Clark had packed me a lunch, out of tuna sandwiches and something else. And we got on the bus, and there was no heat in the bus, and it was zero weather. Colder than hell, snow all over, and I nearly froze to death. On the halfway to Chicago, I ate one of the sandwiches. By the time I got to Chicago, I was absolutely deaf. I got ptomaine, I didn't know that. And I was deathly sick. But I managed to get on another bus for St. Louis. So I get on that bus. There are not too many people on the bus. Maybe there were 10 or 15 people on the bus. It had a center aisle on the bus. A lot of the buses didn't. They had a center aisle. So I finally, about 100 miles or so out of Chicago, we were on the country, I was going to explode. I had to get out of that bus and go to the bathroom. God, I had. So I finally screamed to the bus driver to stop, and here was snow, colder than hell. And the little old heater up in front wasn't giving much heat to the bus. So I got out in the field, and I got rid of everything. And I came back, and I was shaking. I was so weak. Mm-hmm. And the bus driver said, "You sit right here." So he put me something to sit on, and he held me in his arms all the way to St. Louis. And I was feeling a little bit better, so I got on the bus, and finally I got to Denver. I said, "I've had enough of this. I'm still sick." So I got in a hotel room, stayed for 3 or 4 days. And then I remember getting into Santa Fe, and all started to get warm, and here were the pine trees and the mountains, because I missed the mountains so crazy. And so I got home, and I went to work. I worked on these. In the meantime, I was perfecting my ability to make these renderings.
You saw them at
Packard's at Max, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Was Phil Wright still there?
Phil Wright was still there, but not for long. I don't remember when he went or how he went or anything else, but Phil Wright was there. I think Phil Wright was still there. I can't say for sure. But then I was the head honcho there then, because George McCrary was delivering cars to the Stars and this and that and the other thing. And there's a lot of story connected. Oh, God, wait till I get started here.
We'll tell a few.
And so I went to work. And worked on the, but as I say, in the meantime, I had perfected my method. But it took me 3 days to make one of those drawings. But then we had quickies. I have some quickies that I'll do a quickie in a day, you know.
Yeah.
Well, my sister, I think, was still flying, and we went over.
Your mother and sister were glad to see you back.
Oh, of course. We went over to the airport to watch my sister one afternoon.
Pasadena?
No, the Murphy Airport.
Oh, the Murphy Airport. You're still running the air flying circuits.
See, I was only gone, what, four or five months?
That's right, of course.
So I went over that field, and up drove a car I had never seen before, and I absolutely flipped my lid. I went berserk. And I looked it over, and it was a wireless, most gorgeous car, and I still think it's the most beautiful American car ever made. Because it was American design. It wasn't copied from anything in there. It was not copied from Europe. See, the Cadillacs were influenced, all the Cadillacs were influenced by his panel. All doubtful. or the beginning of it. All, say, up to 36 and so on, and the LaSalle. The first LaSalle and the second LaSalle. Even the LaSalle catalog was done with a French theme, the most beautiful catalog. You ever seen one of those catalogs? Oh, God, it's so great. It was lovely. I sold all that stuff when I went to move to Mexico. Anyhow, here was this car, and I knew it was made by Duesenberg. It was Accord. I knew it was.
What year was this now?
It didn't say on it, but I knew it was. It was
29?
Beginning of 29, I think. And
beginning of 1930.
Beginning of 1929.
But the crash had already occurred.
28.
That was late 29.
Was it late 29?
Yeah.
All right. Then it was the beginning of 30. Yeah, it was beginning of 30. Because I spent 30, 31, and 32 back in. So, 30, I spent 30 and 31. And then I went back to Detroit in the beginning of 32, in the wintertime. So it was Accord sedan, and oh God, it was fantastic. And so then,
what model was that?
The Model L.
Model L.
First Model L. And then I remember getting the first Duesenberg. When did Duesenberg come out? 30. I don't remember whether Don't think Duesenberg had come out before I went to Detroit. I think it came out just the minute I got back. When I saw this drawing, I flipped. Oh, God, that Duesenberg. And the first Duesenbergs didn't have the shutters and the radiator. It just had the
louvers?
No, it had a honeycomb grill.
Yeah.
The honeycomb part of the radiator.
When you say shutters, you mean louvers?
No. They had the shutters. Duesenberg had shutters that opened and closed on the radiator.
Yeah.
They all did.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them did.
But
the first one didn't come out. They showed it came out with the radiator showing, the actual radiator showing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the core.
Right. Yeah.
And when we got the Accord drawing, and they wanted E.L. Accord then decided he was going to build a new showroom on Wilshire.
Mm-hmm. Wilshire Boulevard.
Wilshire Boulevard. And
Los Angeles.
And for the cars, for the showing cords, and I guess Duesenbergs. See, there weren't too many Duesenbergs. They only made 475 of the Model J. That's all they ever made. Now they're selling for $1 million. You can't buy a cord Duesenberg for less than $1 million. Mac was telling me they got a big Bugatti, one of the Bugatti Royales, is now on the block for $10 million. Did he tell you that?
I heard the phone call on Harrods.
Yeah. I mean, it's unreal. I could have bought two Duesenberg for $500 when I was back in Detroit. There's a story of my life. Well, we had designed some Duesenberg from some, we got the drawings of the cord, and I finally got a cot there, and I lived there at night. My mother moved to Beverly Hills, and I didn't want to drive every night, so I lived there, right there, in the drafting room.
In Pasadena?
Yeah, and I'd work up to 9, 10 o'clock every night, just because it was fun. I loved it, you know. And I'd go to eat the restaurants over town, I'd get breakfast, and then just live there, sort of almost a night watchman.
Where was the Murphy plant in Pasadena in those days?
Well, it was just east of the Suicide Bridge, which is the big bridge there over where the Rose Bowl is.
Mm-hmm.
See, there's a big wash there, or used to be a river.
Yeah.
And this great, big, beautiful bridge. And the suicide bridge because people used to love to jump off of it and land on the macadam below and squash themselves flat, see. Well, I was so fascinated with that doggone cord that I used to make just drawings just for fun. I mean, different things for fun.
Yeah.
Well, then E.L. Cord decided that he wanted to build some custom-built cords for the opening of the showroom. So he told that, and Frank Spring came up and told me exactly what to do. See, and I did more or less what he wanted done. And I went, God, this stuff is so old and so unexciting. I said, well, to hell with that business, because he said, now E.L. Cord is coming in about 3 or 4 weeks, and he wants to see some designs. So this is what you do. Now I thought, well, to hell with that. I made what he wanted, and I put it aside, and I made 4 or 5, maybe 6 drawings. I think, now to come to think of it, I think Fight Wright was still there because he made 2 drawings also.
Okay.
Wright was still there, that's right. And so I made a drawing of a Phaeton that I liked. I made 4 or 5 drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And the day came when E.L. Cord, he's a
what was
he like? Oh, he was a brusque, a foul-mouthed guy. Oh, his language is terrible. I'd never heard anybody talk like that before, you know.
Was he tall, imposing?
No, he was medium size. I would say he had sort of an Airedale look to him, I think. I'm not sure. You've seen pictures of him. No, I don't know. Maybe it was, don't ask me that. At any rate, he came up there, and we had set up a nice, we had brought a big carpet up there, and we'd had an easel set, and had a coffee pot with coffee and a couple of davenports and so on to make it, you know, a little showroom thing. And we had this easel, and Frank Spinger came up, and he looked at the cards I made. I didn't show him the other cards, see. So he said, well, now he'll like these cards. I had about 4 of them that he wanted. Just very simple card, not.
So wait a minute, what had you done?
I had done 5, or I could show them to you, but I had made 2 coupes, wild coupes, sort of, one of them sort of like Sakhanovsky, but I didn't even know Sakhanovsky.